Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, the great Sam Vecenie returns as we have a rookie intrigue draft. We select the five rookies that we are most excited to watch this upcoming season. Then we shift to the W side. We react to an electric, historic Aces Fever matchup. We then bounce around the league a little bit, check on some contenders. We talk about the Team USA roster. We then talk a little bit about Bonai Jelani Hamilton being waived from the New York Liberty. We'll have more on that on Tuesday, but we hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Balloons!
Okay, we have an abbreviated ludicrous reference, which means one, I am losing my marbles, but two, we have a guest coming back to the program is the great Sam Vecenie of the Game Theory Podcast. Sam, welcome back. How are you doing?
So, guys, I have to just start here. So I know you guys just had your 500th episode. I think I'm 501, right? And the reason that I love this show, and I've told Nikias this privately, like, this is really the only basketball show that I will, like, watch or listen to or anything like that, because I don't like having opinions, like, infiltrate my own process, right? Mm-hmm. But when I get on the call, and this is such an encapsulation of why I love the show and why I listen to it, you two are just losing your minds laughing, like, off air about Nikias, you know, like, being interested in the Utah Jazz. And I think that that's why, like, this show has been so successful and why I love it so much. It's like, it's not just like a, for people who wonder, is this just like some fake thing, like, you know, on the internet, these two guys, they're, you know, just co-hosts and nothing. No, these guys are real. They're having fun off air. This is great. Chemistry is valid. I promise you. Congrats on 500, guys, and, you know, hopefully for 500 more.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're going to have many more Utah conversations, I would imagine, probably on this podcast, much to the chagrin of Steve, but I do appreciate the kind words and the well wishes. We have a very, very basic premise for the show today. We are doing a rookie intrigue draft. We are selecting five rookies apiece. Not necessarily who's the best, not necessarily who's going to have the best career, though it can be that if that's part of your reasoning. It is just, who are we excited to watch in this upcoming NBA season? Our great producer, Sarah, has a name randomizer ready for us so we can determine who's going to get the top pick, because Steve always, you know, accuses me of cheating when we have drafts and things. So this is not going to be my funny.
Once again, what do you know? Oh, somehow it lands on the Nikias.
Oops, that noodles. That is very funny timing on my part. But I can't say I didn't do it. So I am scot-free, but it looks like I'll be selecting first. And so to kick this off, we're going to see who gets the second
pick. Who's two and three? Jeez Louise.
Hold on.
It's me!
There we go. Steve will be selecting second, which means Sam will be picking third and then fourth. This is going to be a snake-style draft. Cool. So I was talking to Steve a little bit before the show, and it's like, huh, whoever gets third, they just get two of the top four if they are intrigued by the top four. We're going to see. We haven't discussed our picks naturally. But this should be a fun time. So without further ado, we're going to tap into the draft. Or Steve, did you have a thought before we got going?
I was going to ask a question.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, I think all of us view young talent a little bit differently. What makes you intrigued by a prospect? And I wanted to ask Sam, especially as you watch them in college, kind of see a little taste in summer league, and you watch them going forward, what intrigues you about that transition?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, the way, so I'll just kind of give a filter. Who are the guys I'm most interested in watching as rookies? Because as you guys know, development, it isn't always linear, right? Mm-hmm. These guys take different tracks to be able to become the players that they're going to be. And, you know, for instance, a player that I have a little bit lower on my list to watch as a rookie is Cam Boozer. I just kind of know what that's going to look like. Like, I know that his process is really high level, that he thinks through things at a very, like, at a genuinely elite clip in terms of the way that he's able to process the game. He's going to make the right decisions as a passer. He's going to shoot the ball at like a 35 to 40% clip. I think there's some margin for error in that range. I think he's going to be able to make great decisions in terms of shoot or pass. And I think that he moves incredibly well without the ball. Whereas somebody like Caleb Wilson, I think he's a little bit less of a complete player right now. Defensively, it is hit or miss from time to time, especially in terms of rotation and his awareness of what's happening on the court. I think that his on-ball defense leaves something to be desired from time to time. So a lot of the time, just in terms of the word intriguing, right, what I'm watching for is, okay, I have all of these notes that I've taken while these guys played high school basketball, while they took college while they played college basketball. Are they improving? Are they showcasing real room for growth? Are they showcasing that they're getting better at the things that they have to get better at? Otherwise, are they stagnating in some way, shape, or form? So that's, when you say the word intriguing, that's what my mind goes to. What about you guys?
I'll answer my own question. I think for me, it's like, what I think for me, their context is important. Like what kind of team they're on, what's their runway, how important are they to a certain thing for a team? Like, okay, AJ and Summer League was one thing. If that looks the same as far as like scaled down, you can do some of this, but we have help around you. Does that pop more? Like, are you able to kind of do more things defensively? Like Amores Johnson Jr., like, do you pop because of the things you do defensively in an NBA context? Like, is there opportunity for Braden Burries to kind of do way more? Like, I'm always intrigued to see, okay, your skill set dictates this, but your team may need this. Are you able to expand on that? Are you able to fill that need? Are you able to find a level of consistency? What's your niche? What's your role? What's your opportunity? Can you find something that sticks early? And then can you build on that? So that's kind of where my mind goes to, okay, I'm intrigued to see your talent level is X, your skill set is Y. We know you can do this, but what do you do every single night?
I love that answer. I would say for me, there is naturally a baseline level of intrigue because unlike Sam, I'm not watching a bunch in college right now. So like Summer League is a lot of my firm introduction to a lot of these players. So I'm always just like, okay, what can I learn about these players in general? And I think to bounce off of what you said, Steve, I am intrigued by like the context and the overall opportunity. Like, how well are these players going to translate to the NBA level is like one broader question. But like, based on what the context is, based on where they're going to slide into the rotation, based on what the teammate talent is like, et cetera, how quickly is that transition going to happen or translation going to happen? How smooth will it be? That's where it kind of goes for me. Like, who's actually going to have an opportunity to showcase what they can do? And so that's where like Braden Burries was brought up a little bit earlier. Steve and I talked about him during Summer League, super in on what the Summer League experience was for him. Within the context of this draft, he's lower on my list because the Bucks have 87 guards and it's less, I don't think he's going to be good, and more, okay, is he playing 28 minutes? Is he playing 17 minutes? Is it going to be 12 minutes and then somebody gets traded? And then in the second half of the year, I'm watching him a lot. So I just don't know where that part is going to land. So the opportunity piece, Steve, I love that part of your answer in particular. Like, that's where a lot of this came down for me. Like, who's actually going to get a chance to showcase some stuff?
Yeah, I love it.
So, all right, from there, let's roll into the draft. I have
the He can't wait to make this pick. Look at his face. He's glowing right now.
Oh, man. I tell you what, it brings me no great pleasure to depart from a Sam opinion like 5 minutes into the podcast. But the number one pick for me is, in fact, Cam Boozer, because of how well he processes the floor, because of how good he is. I am excited to see what he looks like in this Memphis context. As Steve and I talked about on Tuesday, we power ranked the non-playoff teams in the Western Conference. I had Memphis, I think, third on my list, because I like the collection of talent that they have. I like the system that they're going to be running. I think they're going to get a little bit more buy-in collectively with what they're going to run. I'm excited to see what Cam Boozer next to Zach Edey looks like. I'm excited to see what Ty Jerome pick and roll with Cam Boozer is going to look like, and just his general versatility offensively and how he's going to be moved around the board. And so in addition to him being very good, I think there's a team context that should accentuate what he does. There are players around him that should be able to grow with him, like him plus Cedric Howard. We saw flashes of that in Summer League of how good that could be. And now we're just going to get a full slate of regular season basketball to see those two guys grow together. And so Cam Boozer is where it starts for me with top billing.
Yeah, for me, you know, it has nothing to do with Cam Boozer. I love Cam Boozer as a player. I think he's fantastic. It's more, I just kind of, I feel like I know what that looks like because I've watched him since he was a sophomore in high school. Right? Yeah. So where it's like less interesting for me, I can totally understand why it's so interesting for you because I think he's going to be awesome. To bounce off of what you said, though, what's most interesting to me is that I want to see how the Edie Boozer combination works because I think they could do some really fun stuff running like four or five ball screens with Boozer as the ball handler. Mm-hmm. I think you could do some really fun high-low actions with them. I think that you could really just have a team kind of ass kickers. Like they have Zach Edie, they have Isaiah Stewart, Cam Boozer, super physical. Like I kind of think they're going to be miserable to play against in the regular season this year if Edie is healthy because those dudes are physical as hell and nobody's going to want to deal with all that like just force being put on them night after night in the middle of like December and January and February in the regular season.
Are they just going to leave the NBA in Gortats?
Oh, gosh.
I figured I'd toss the question out there. Steve, go ahead.
I was going to add on to both of y'all's points. It's the versatility he showed in summer league that made me excited as far as how he can be used within the Memphis offense and what that could mean as far as being on ball, being off ball, being used in different ways. And I think that can open a lot up. So good choice, Nikias. Not surprised you went there at all. I feel a lot of pressure with this number two pick. But I am the most intrigued to watch A.J. Devonta is going to be my pick first. And I think it's because of his skill set and his talent. I think the confidence and force that he plays with, the way he kind of glides driving-wise, his ability to get to his own shot. But that being in a Washington context that doesn't need him to do that all the time. So, like, obviously they're going to have to do a lot better defensively to take care of his ability to get out in the open court. But if you have a Trae Young and you have an Anthony Davis, they're kind of pillars, so he can kind of fill some gaps. So you can grow within our like what we think you can hit ceiling-wise without us needing you to do it all the time. And so that's my intrigue level there as far as, okay, you can get to whatever spot you want. You can change directions. You can set up your drives. What happens when you do that on a swing? What happens when you're out in the open court? What happens if it's a kick to you? What happens when someone's screening for you? So I think watching him be able to grow into a team that needs him to be really good without handing him all of the keys is very fun. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm like, the comfort that I think he displayed in summer league is where I'm intrigued to see what it looks like in the regular season. So I'm gonna go with A.J. Devonta.
Yeah, and to bounce off of that, Steve, what I'm interested in most is actually what happens when he doesn't have the ball. You know what I mean? Mm. Because this is a situation, like you said, with Trae Young, where he's not going to have the ball every single time down the court. That's just not the reality of what he's going to be asked to do. At BYU, everything ran through him. At Utah Prep, everything ran through him. Basically, throughout his high school life, because of who he was as a player, everything ran through A.J. Devonta, right? So is it a situation where he gets easier looks by playing off of the ball and doing exactly what you said? Like, man, he could be so elite at attacking closeouts off of like swing passes. He could be so great out in the open court. We know that already. Okay, what does it look like whenever he's the third option on the court because Anthony Davis and Trae Young are out there? That's the kind of thing that we don't know yet about AJ. And that's why, I'm very, very interested in what AJ looks like in this specific Washington situation.
I think AJ is going to be pretty fun in that spot, but I'm right there with you. Like what the off-ball utility is going to look like should be pretty interesting. I'm also just generally curious, one, where to pull up three lands for him because he took a lot during the Vegas Summer League portion, and just where the defense lands because he has the tools. I will just say kindly, there have been varying opinions about the A.J. Devonta defense experience based on his long season in college. And so I just want to see for myself when we get to NBA action how good or bad he's going to be on that end. And now we swing it back to you, Sam, as you have the next two picks of the intrigue draft.
You guys left me the number one and number two on my board. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. This worked out really well for me.
Well done.
The number one player on my board is Caleb Wilson. I am fascinated to see what Caleb Wilson looks like this year because, man, when he's rolling, it is a downhill force of just power and explosiveness. On top of that, if we're talking that he can shoot now, like we saw at Summer League, sort of, there was a game there against Memphis where it looked absolutely phenomenal. His last game, it looked okay, I would say. I think he made like 2 of 8 or something like that. If he can actually take and make pull-up threes and have that kind of gravity, I think he's got a real shot to be the best player in this draft. Like, I feel very interested in that upside. If he still doesn't have that necessarily, I'm curious to see how everything else kind of goes. He's going to average, just if Chicago continues to play an up-tempo scheme. You know, Billy Donovan obviously not there, but it did feel like they found some success playing up-tempo in the way that they wanted to last year. And on top of that, if they're able to utilize like Josh Giddey getting out in transition to find Caleb, I think he's going to average like 19-9 or something this year. Like, he's going to average big numbers just because he's going to play 30 minutes a night, I would imagine. Like, I think he's probably the guy that has, even more so than AJ DeBonta, like a really clear path to super high level production along with Cam Boozer and Nikias. So I'm fascinated to watch Caleb Wilson. More than anything, I'm really interested to watch him on defense, because I think people got really excited about everything that we saw at Summer League with the block shots and everything you saw there. The recovery ability. The recovery ability is elite. There's no doubt about that. It's what happens before you have to get into recovery that I think sometimes can be very, very questionable with Caleb Wilson.
I guess the one question I'll toss your way, as Chicago is starting to stock up on like 6'8", 6'9", athletic wings, like, do you think they will be able to find minutes for everyone within this group? Or do you feel like someone's going to end up getting the short end of the stick as they try to build this out?
I mean, like, I'm just kind of assuming that Noah Essengay is going to be the one who, like, doesn't play a whole lot, just because, A, I think he's not really ready to play yet, based off of what we saw at Summer League and based off of what he looked like in his pre-draft year. And then B, he wasn't drafted by this this front office alignment. Like, Bryson Graham and, you know, Steven Mervis, like, those guys didn't draft Noah. So, like, I assume that they don't have the connection to him that the AK, you know, Mark Eversley combination did. So without that kind of connection, I have some real questions as to how connected they are to Essengay at this point.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Steve, did you have anything on Caleb Wilson?
No, I think it was nailed. Because okay. I know there's a whole nother pick for Sam, and I also have to think of my pick. So, no, I'm good.
Fair enough. Well, Sam, to kick off the second round, who do you have?
Well, I'm going to keep it easy. I'm going to take Darren Peterson. If these two hadn't fallen to me, I might have gone outside the top four at number four. But I think that with Darren Peterson, it's exactly what Steve opened the show with. It's the team context, right? Because for Utah to reach its ceiling, so much of it is now Darren Peterson. Like, they're pretty, I wouldn't say they're locked in on what they have, but they're paying a pretty substantial amount of money right now for this roster based off of the idea that Darren Peterson can be a number one option, or maybe Ace Bailey has some equity there as well. We know Lauri Markkanen isn't quite a number one option on like a title team. We know that Jaren Jackson isn't a number one option on a title team. I love those guys as number two and number three. I love the depth they've built with guys like Bryce Sensabaugh. Even like, you know, Kyle Filipowski is like a really solid third big who can play the four and can play the five and moves intelligently without the ball and can shoot it and can do a whole lot of different things offensively. I think this roster is really well set. It's just beckoning for that number one option. So I'm most fascinated this year to see what kind of flashes we get from Darren Peterson that can make you buy into him being that number one guy. To really accentuate Utah's build long term here.
I like it. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, I was going to say, I love the fit as well, as far as his skill set, far as being on ball and off ball within what Utah wants to do, and how Utah will just, Will Hardy will take the best of what you do and make it fit within everything, and we can invert things, we'll find a way. So I think that marriage is going to be really good for Darren Peterson, especially with what he's been able to show as a reminder of, I can drive, I can play make a little bit, I can open things up. So it's a good blend for me. I think that's going to be really, really fun to watch. Salt Lake City, we're here for you, apparently.
Yes, well, we are. Also this
too, like, Steve, I'll say this too as well. Like, I love the offensive fit with Keyonte George and Darren Peterson. Like, defensively, I have some questions in terms of just what that'll look like. But offensively, I think those two within this offense under Will Hardy, the ability to now have like two guys who can play both on and off the ball, I think is so essential for what Utah is building. And I'm really, really excited to see how Will Hardy utilizes those two as well.
I'm right there with you. I will save my Utah thoughts. I've given enough this week. I want to make sure I keep Steve as a co-host for the next 500 episodes. So, Steve, you are up. Who is your pick in the second round of the intrigue draft?
You know, it's funny because you become Utah fan and then I become non-Utah person. And that's just not true, but we can address that later. I'm going to the left. I'm going to take Yaxel Lindeborg. I'm going to go ahead and say I'm intrigued to see what he looks like. I think he does a little bit of everything. He's going to a Golden State team where doing a little bit of everything could mean a lot. What does that marriage look like as far as him being able to fit in with that context? Can he kind of hit the right notes defensively consistently? And what does that mean? Can he elevate with his ability to kind of make good decisions when he's spaced, to be able to knock shots down, be able to drive? Can he use him as a screener? Like, I think his total skill set can fit what Golden State likes to do as far as just being a smart basketball player, being someone who doesn't really have a ton of like, you really can't do this, has some dog in him. But I think the defense has to hit at a certain level for him to nail all the notes in Golden State. But if you're telling me they add someone who can drive, who can shoot, who is smart, that's literally what Golden State wants every single night. And they need him to kind of hit a lot of the notes. So I'm intrigued to see how Steve Kerr wants to use him, how he fits in with the Warriors team. But I think his skill set, in theory, and obviously, you know, having played a lot of college basketball, he should be ready to contribute at a high level. So I'm intrigued to see if he can help push the Warriors back into a different direction.
Yeah, I love Yax. I had him as a top 10 guy in the class. I think that he is ready to go from day one. We saw it at Summer League. He won MVP of Summer League. And I thought it was rightful, to be honest. I thought that he did an amazing job of just, he has this skills that is so special in terms of he can both be the guy at times, like in college, but also he was really happy to kind of sink back at times too and be like, okay, you need me to guard the opposing team's best perimeter player? I'll do that. You need me to, you know, just kind of be the connective tissue guy who makes quick swing passes and makes quick decisions? I'll do all that too. Like, I'm really comfortable within my own skin as a basketball player. I'm glad you brought up the defense, Steve. I thought that he was messier on defense in Summer League than what I expected. How much of that was new scheme, you know, just coming back from a pre-draft process that can be somewhat grueling, you know, who knows, right? Like, there are 45 different reasons. I totally agree with you that I think the defense is such a critical part of his evaluation. I would expect that he'll be quite good on defense based off of what we saw at Michigan this year and what we saw at UAB.
Yeah, I would imagine Draymond's not going to let him slack on that based on some of the barbs we've seen between those two during the summer process. But I'm super excited.
And those personalities are going to be really fun. Not in a bad way. Like, I think those two could have some like real fun together with the way that they both talk, man. They both really talk.
Yeah, they're going to feed off of each other. I'm so playfully mad at Steve because Yax was 4 on my board, and I was so excited to lead off this selection with him. But that's fine. I'll continue down my draft board since I have the next two. One, someone that I spoke about a little bit earlier this summer with Summer League reactions. I'm just kind of in on the Cameron Carr experience in L.A. I think his blend of athleticism and shooting is going to be very fun for that team. I did dig deep. Give me a wing that can fly and a wing that can shoot, and I'm just kind of in, and he seems to do that. And you're telling me he's going to be playing alongside Luka Doncic, assuming that he's going to have to gain some weight, get stronger. And we're talking about the long-term projection. But a Luka Doncic that likes to throw these hit-aheads, can find cutters, can find guys in the corners, in particular if you put two on the ball against them, he can fire those live ball lasers. Cam Carr can knock down shots. I love the utilization of Cam Carr during Summer League. A whole lot of pin downs, let him curl and get downhill, was able to attack, got into some touch finishes in the middle of the floor, was a dribble away from getting into some legitimate rim attacks. He took some movement threes during Summer League as well. So I'm just like, hey, if there's a legit off-ball utility, if there's transition value and just overall athleticism here, he just seems like a really fun long-term fit. And so that's where I will start with this. Sam, I'll ask you, like, what are your overall impressions on Cam Carr?
I love the offensive fit. I think it's an amazing fit next to Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves. I could not agree with you more. He's going to have to guard, is the reality. Like, he's going to have to get stronger and he's going to have to guard. Now, he is like 6'4" with a 7'1" wingspan. He is very long, very toolsy, has a chance to be okay on defense. But what he has to do is he has to play with better bend. He has to be able to access that bend. Because he's so long, he also kind of has high hips. And I think he can just get really displaced a little bit too easily. And, you know, the positioning was not always there at Baylor. Again, another guy with like crazy recovery ability who could get steals and could get weak side blocks and could make all sort of awesome plays. But the key to him getting playing time this year is going to be the defensive end, in my opinion. The offense, he'll make 36-37% of his threes, if not higher. He's going to be able to get out in transition as a good partner with Luka Doncic. It's the defense for me to see if he's going to be able to play night after night.
No, I like the way he was used as far as like to Nikias's point. Like, okay, I can see the vision of how he can help the Lakers, especially, you know, with shout out to my guy Ty Abbott running him off all the staggers and screens and getting him handoffs. Okay, let's see what he can kind of accomplish in those scenarios, because those would be a little bit more realistic on the big team. But I think I agree, the defense is going to be at a certain level for him to kind of pop and hit the ceiling that I think people would want him to. But it's a good find for the Lakers. So two thumbs up. Good job, Nikias. Is it my turn or is it still your turn?
No, I have the second pick. I'll go quick on this one. Going to be very on brand, as if all of my picks haven't been on brand so far. I'm going to go Allen Graves in Toronto.
I knew it.
I knew it.
Look, I have Allen on my board. So I'm genuinely in on this with Nikias.
Steve, I almost brought back the old hashtag from, I think, season one or season two when talking about all the Memphis rookies. I'm not going to do that to you since we've already talked about Utah. But Allen Graves, very good at basketball. High IQ, can pass, can finish, can defend, can fly around off the ball. I love some of the rotations that he was able to make during Summer League this year. And you had add him to this nucleus in Toronto that already has Scotty Barnes on the super high end, Kylie Murray-Boyles, who I couldn't be more excited about. Now you're adding Allen Graves to this mix. He shot well from three in Summer League. Like, I'm curious to see what the overall volume and how defenses are going to treat him on the NBA level from that end. So I don't know how often we'll actually get to see like Graves plus CMB plus Scotty together in any lineups. But selfishly, I would like to see at least some stretches of that. Like, give me an early second quarter bit or mid third quarter bit with those three on the floor. Just let them fly around defensively and just make high IQ plays. That'd be the abbreviated version of why I'm intrigued to see Allen Graves. Just a really good basketball player.
Really smart basketball player. I'm fascinated to see how the athleticism translates early on. If there's an adjustment period in terms of just, I'm dealing with these athletes night after night after night. I actually like him way more on offense than I do on defense right now. I think that he makes decisions so quickly. He's so good at screening. He knows, he just has this intense, innate understanding of space, is the easiest way to put it. He understands where he needs to be in order to be the most dangerous version of himself on offense, and he makes those quick decisions. Defensively, I think he's really good at the chaos rotation. I think he's really good at making those like quick split second decisions. It's okay, can he guard on the ball? If a team gets him in a switch, is he going to be quick enough to be able to stay in front of somebody? Is he going to be able to consistently deal on the block? Like, if he ends up having to play some four, maybe even like he played a lot of five at Santa Clara. That was his main position, like 80% of the time. And in games where Jakob Poeltl is out and they start calling Murray-Boyles, is he the backup five? I kind of think he's the backup five right now, or at least the third string five, let's go with, in games where Poeltl misses. And, you know, bigs miss games, that happens. So I totally agree. Like, Allen Graves wouldn't have been my pick this time. He might have been my pick coming back, Nikias. So I think this is a great pick. I totally get it.
I like being in the middle of Nikias and Sam. I feel like I'm just like a buffer. Like, I'm just like the perfect buffer. You never know if I'm going left or right, but I'm just in between those two. So it's fun. I would like to see, like, Allen Graves totally enjoyed his summer league. I'm imagining, what if we saw like Scotty Barnes, Colin Murray-Boyles, Allen Graves, and insert player whose name we can't necessarily say at certain points in time. You know what I mean?
Ah, I see.
Plus guard, you know what I mean? I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah,
okay. I'll get to my pick.
Grady Dick.
Going with, I'm the
That's the one.
I'm going with Mykal Brown Jr. as far as intrigue goes. And a lot of this is the context. I think what you see from Brooklyn is we need you to be really good. Him and Yegor Diemin being able to kind of just do different things. But I just like his feel for the game. I think offensively, you saw just the flashes of like confident ball handling. Drives, he'll have to get a little bit more physical, but like willingness to drive the basketball. Comfort to get to his spots and shoot and get the step back or the pull up. But the defense is what kind of intrigued me as far as just like the effort and the mindset to understand, okay, maybe I can make some of these like efforts to communicate. Maybe I could be active off ball. Maybe I could be in the right position to disrupt passing lanes. And so if you were having that kind of blend within like an opportunity in Brooklyn to play a lot of minutes and grow within that, I want to see what that totally looks like. So can that defense grow to a certain level offensively? Can you find the comfort because you'll have the opportunities? Are you going to have someone who can drive, take pull-ups and shots, make the right reads and pass, and then have enough defense to now elevate? So for me, it's like, this is a good opportunity to see how good you could be. I think the reps will pay off down the line.
I mean, we're assuming he's starting day one, right? Like, that's what I'm imagining here. He's definitely better than Nolan Traore, in my opinion. So I'm guessing that he starts next to Jaeger. An absolute home run hitter. Mykal Brown's best plays are as good as anybody in this draft class outside of the top four guys. Probably. His worst plays make you question whether or not Jordy Fernandez is going to like bench him for entire second halves because he's just an absolute home run hitter is the reality. And I don't mean that as a slight. He has vision that other players like just can't be taught, right? He sees things on the court that other guys just don't see. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I think the key for him throughout his rookie season is finding the right balance of, oh my God, like I'm Bartolo Colon swinging for the fences here versus, oh no, I'm Bartolo Colon, you know, trying to hit a home run and my helmet flies off of my head and you know, on my knee in the batter's box having missed the ball, right? So it's a big blend of I need to figure out what my limits are, but also try to expand what those limits can be. Right? Because I think that he has that ability. He's a genuinely special talent.
That might be the first and maybe only Bartolo Colon reference that we have ever gotten on the Dunker Spot podcast through 500 plus episodes. I am so impressed, and I'm not even a baseball guy. I am so impressed how we pulled that one together. The only thing I'll add, was just going back through some of my notes from Summer League when we talked about him. And I think it was the Kings game where they consistently put two on the ball because they just put two on the ball against everyone. And some of the passing reads he was making, I was like, ah, yeah, I think I'm going to like this guy. I'm already going to be watching a bunch of Nets games anyway, because that's just who I am. But I was like, okay, if he's got some passing juice like this, if he's got some pick and roll craft, I'm going to have a lot more fun watching Brooklyn this year. Or at the very least, I hope I'm going to have a lot more fun watching Brooklyn this year.
All right, so I got back-to-back picks here. All right. Oh, so boy. First, I'm gonna go Keaton Wagler, and okay. I think people just like way overreacted to Keaton Wagler's first summer league game. He figured things out so quickly in summer league in terms of just, all right, I'm gonna get blitzed on the ball. Like he got Emmanuel Sharp is what happened. Emmanuel Sharp is an absolute dog on defense. He's a monster on that end. He is gonna make life miserable for everybody, but. Also, the Kings like blitzed the ball like crazy and just asked him to make the right reads. And he just made the right short roll passing read like every single time. He's a super unselfish player. He's always going to make the right decision. He's always going to be the guy that is trying to, you know, advance the cause of the team versus advance the cause of himself. And it's going to be funny whenever I make my next pick, how to compare and contrast these two players. But I think that with Keaton, where I'm fascinated is, okay, can he get by guys? Can he consistently find his way past players whenever he doesn't have a ball screen? Or does he need a ball screen all the time? How much do the Clippers utilize him off of the ball? is another question for me. I thought that a lot of his best success at Summer League came being utilized in off-ball actions where he'd come up and then maybe catch a ball screen, right? Mm-hmm. Get him on the move a little bit early so he can actually utilize that athleticism he has. He's a genuinely special basketball brain. He is a guy that is all about making the team better. I love that the Clippers drafted him at number 5. It would have been my pick as well. And I think he has some runway here to really try to figure out who he can be as a player.
I like this selection quite a bit. Like, this is someone that I was at the Kings Clipper game and wrote about it for Yahoo Sports. And it was a game where, again, a lot of people were like, what happened here? And I wrote, like, some of these drives, he wasn't able to generate separation, but also make sure to note, he did get blitzed a bunch and he got off the ball. Like, I was kind of mapping what some of the velocity on some of those passes were, but generally made the right decisions. And I know that I liked how they were able to try to move him off the ball a little bit, get him some catches on the move. And as Summer League went on, as you already mentioned, Sam, we saw more of that. And he looked more comfortable. He got a little bit more aggressive and you got to see more of the blend of what he can be. So I like it. I'm right there with you. Steve, Jeff, Keaton, thoughts?
When I talk to the Illinois staff, what they say is, like, his best skill is his ability to solve problems. Figures out what the defense is doing and how he has to adjust better than anybody. I'm sorry, Steve. Go ahead.
Oh, you're good. Shout out to the Illinois staff. I think it's just, I like the fight that he had as far as trying to figure it out, trying to figure the physicality out, trying to find a way to make an impact in different ways. That's valuable experience. It may not be the thing that gets all the headlines Summer League-wise, but that's good stuff. What is your next pick, Sam?
All right, I'm going Darius Acuff next. Look, I get it that, you know, look, sometimes with Darius, it doesn't always come at the expense of great offense for the team, right? But man, I think he can create shots. I think he can get real ball screen, you know, reps where he's able to get into that mid-range area and knock down shots. Now, I thought at Summer League, I don't know if it was just him pressing or whatever, and I think this got better as he played like game 2, game 3, game 4 at Summer League. But man, it was just way too geared toward the shot, right? What I really liked about Acuff at Arkansas this year was I hated watching him in high school. Like, genuinely might have been my least favorite high school player to watch in that class, right? And what he did at Arkansas was he figured out the blend of shooting and passing at a really high level. And I loved that he figured that out, right? Like, that's when I say, you know, how I opened this show. All right, are we showing growth in the areas that we need to show growth in, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought that Darius showed so much growth this year at Arkansas in terms of, all right, I'm playing with good players around me. I can throw this lob on a backside cut. I can hit this short roll pass. I can consistently make the right read. Instead, at Summer League, I think he geared it a little bit too much toward trying to be the guy. I would just love to see him, hopefully, as he starts to play with guys like Zach LaVine, guys like Domantas Sabonis, you know, Max Reynaud, Nick Clifford, whoever else you want to call out. You know, Emmanuel Sharpe, I think, is going to play real minutes on this team, if you made me guess. Like, can he consistently moderate that jump shot versus the pass and make more consistent reads that sometimes aren't always going to lead to an assist, but they're going to get you the hockey assist, right? To be able to get the offense more flowing.
Sam went back to back on people that I wanted to select. I want to add this on Acuff. I think that, like, I enjoyed that he found comfort and patience as Summer League went on. And you mentioned Domantas Sabonis. Mm-hmm. I feel like that will help him overall. As far as, you don't necessarily have to create a lot of these. I can play with you. We can develop a chemistry. And now you can leverage that scoring ability and make some of these reads more comfortably. So I think he's in a good opportunity to have taken a hit, but also find a way to digest it and get back to what I do without, you know, and being in a context where, yes, you need me to do this, but I don't have to do every single play. So I think maybe that can be bottled up into a good thing for Sacramento.
Well, and Steve, to that point too, what I think is really fun about Acuff with this fit with Sabonis is, man, Arkansas had so much success this year playing him off of the ball, starting him off of the ball, and then having him run off of different actions, having him run off of different screens. Man, you can put the ball in high to Sabonis at the top of the key and have Acuff running off of all sorts of different actions, get into zoom actions, whatever you want to run. And I think he can have some really fun, creative offensive opportunities with Sabonis particularly?
I'll just say very quickly before Steve, you make your pick. Sam, you probably have a better handle on this as you talk to a lot of different people. But one of my favorite moments of Summer League was, I can't remember after which game it was, but Darius Acuff's given the post-game interview, and he's like, yeah, I just didn't shoot well enough. We got the win, but I got to play better. Just like that kind of self-awareness, that kind of self, you know, criticism in a way. And it's like, okay, I would be a little worried if he didn't see some of this stuff. And it kind of bounces off your point about him kind of altering his approach from high school to college. So I guess we'll see how he's able to continue to develop from there.
Yeah, I think he has the self-awareness. I'm not worried about self-awareness. It is a willingness to implement those things sometimes. Like, you know, I've talked to people pre-draft to talk to him, and he would like really acknowledge, like, yeah, I was terrible on defense at Arkansas. Like, yeah, I didn't guard well enough at Arkansas. And then they'd ask him, like, well, like, what are you going to do to change that? And, you know, he like really talked, I guess, about like trying to, you know, he really takes pride in his one-on-one matchup, but doesn't always consistently, you know, give as much attention to the off-ball side of the defensive court. And I mean, at that size, there's just no margin for error off the ball defensively. So is he going to be able to consistently implement the knowledge that he has no margin for error, or is he going to kind of fall back in a different way? We'll see. I'm fascinated to find out.
And that's what the intrigue is for. Steve, your selection.
Merez Johnson Jr. The beauty of being sandwiched in between Nekias and Sam is sometimes you can wreck a draft, sometimes you can pivot, or you can just touch into your soul and believe in what you believe in. So I'm believing in the defense of potential of Merez Johnson Jr. And so, like, I think reps are going to be important for him. I think the activity is something that stands out from the jump. And so being able to have someone who's active, can defend multiple positions, is able to rotate on time, on target, that's something you can build on early and kind of just continue to build on. And I think the drives that he showcased in Summer League were really important. I think within the Dallas context, how good can he be on either end of the floor? Like, offensively, defensively, what does that do to their lineup structure? Who can he play with? Like, I think there's a lot of things to play around with. But if you give me the dog mentality, the consistent activity, if he can grow into someone who can switch and defend a lot of different positions, if he can nail some of the weak side rotations, I think that's someone that I want to watch and see, okay, what does your growth process look like? What things are you adding every single night? Because I think I made the mistake with Colin Murray-Boyles and not understanding how significant that defensive impact would be as he grew into different things offensively. So can Morez kind of hit that track as far as I'm going to do X, Y, and Z defensively, you can count on this, and then we can use me on the other end. So I'm going there.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I am a huge Merez Johnson fan. Was my top big in the class at the end of the day. I think he is. Look, you talk to the Michigan staff and they would just tell you, man, he was our barometer every single day. If our guys were like dragging ass for whatever reason, or, you know, we needed somebody to like kind of light a fire every day in practice, it was him. And it was Will Chatter, their senior, but like it was really him at the end of the day that was able to do it. And now with Dusty May there, you would expect that that's going to be able to continue at the end of, like, he's going to be able to bring that intensity every single day in practice to the extent that you can during a grueling NBA season, at least. But I'm a big Merez Johnson guy. I'm a total believer in his mentality, the professionalism that he brings to the table, the attitude, on top of being just really smart rotationally, like you said, Steve.
I love that selection. I'll just quickly say, like, Warriors Mavericks during Summer League was probably my favorite game of the cycle. Just watching him and Jaxel Lindeberg just take turns making highlight plays on both ends of the floor is just a whole lot of fun. I am excited to watch Morez and Cooper Flagg defend at the same time, and just different forward slash wing combinations that the Mavs can get to. We talked about them on Tuesday, so they're still fresh for me. I love the selection for you, Steve.
And Nekias, before we move on, like, how does the big situation sort out in Dallas is really fascinating too, because, you know, does Daniel Gafford get moved before the season, or is he on the roster? What does Derek Lively look like? Like, I still have Derek Lively stock. Like, I think if he's healthy, he is a real impact starting caliber center in the NBA. Can you play Lively and Merez Johnson together at times? Like, what does it look like if you play Merez and PJ Washington? Are you a little bit too undersized, or are they just like big and burly enough to make it work? I think there are just so many fascinating roster and lineup constructions at play with Dallas that this, I think this is a great pick. Yeah.
I'm right there with you. Okay. So I get to go back to back to round out my roster. I'm afforded some homer picks. So I'm going to make my homer picks right now. So one, as a UConn guy, I kind of have to go Terrence Reed Jr.
Oh,
an absolute monster on the offense. Honestly, he just might. Like, I don't know if this is going to be Wimby plays 36 minutes a game during the regular season, in addition to any kind of injuries that might pop up. I think there's going to be some room for him to come in as third or fourth big and just kind of wreck stuff.
Yeah.
Screen, be used as a hub sometimes. If you want to go drop coverage against San Antonio, if that turns into a late switch ever, Terrence is sealing you underneath the basket. And if the shot goes up, he's probably beating you to the offensive glass. Like, I think there's going to be some real – it wouldn't surprise me if he averages, like, 10 minutes a game and, like, his EPM is higher than it should be, and I just get to be disingenuous about it for, like, a two-week stretch during the regular season. But I am excited to see, like, what he looks like as part of San Antonio's big man rotation.
Steve, how do you feel about the EPM discussion? How do you feel about Nekias disingenuously using stats?
Preparing for the inevitable is what I do, Sam. That's what I'm prepared to do that. I will say this, Nekias. I am intrigued by the offensive rebounding, and I am intrigued by his ability to be a roller. And can he do enough stuff defensively? Because San Antonio said, look, what happened with our backup big situation? Never again. We're never dealing with that again. So I'm intrigued to see if he can kind of take the steps early on to kind of grab some things. I'll leave the EPM for October 17th when he has an 8 offensive rebound, 16 point plus 19 performance against the Wizards or something.
Look, I think that Terrace is like and Alan Graves, Nekias, wittingly or unwittingly doing this is interesting to me. So in terms of like who he's drafted, every team that you talk to pre-draft, pre-offseason, everything like that, they talked about winning the possession battle. And look, I know it's obvious, hey, you want more possessions than the other team, but I think even more right now, there is a serious impetus on trying to win the possession battle. And I know the coach brain in Steve's head is like, mother effer, like, we've been talking about this for years. We got to rebound the ball. Like, what are you guys talking about? Like, when you talk to front office people, it's like, man, like, rebounding and getting second chance offensive rebounds is really important right now. Trying to find a way into creating extra opportunities to score the basketball or killing other teams from getting extra opportunities. Like, a huge part of, you know, how Boston is successful is they pick up the low hanging fruit with 3-point rate and with rebounding. Huge part of why Phoenix is successful was they pick up the low-hanging fruit with 3-point rate and offensive rebounding particularly. They're pretty bad on the defensive end. Charlotte as well. 3-point rate, offensive and defensive rebounding. Like, I think those are the three models that people are looking at where they're going, oh man, like, these three teams from a talent perspective probably exceeded their talent last year basically by picking up this low-hanging fruit. And I think that, to tie it back to what this pick was, Terrence Reed kind of exemplifies that in some way, shape, or form to me because of the ability to crash the offensive and defensive glass.
Very glad that we got some possession talk on this here podcast. We got the full blend on this episode of the Dunker Spot. Last one for me as I'm sticking with the homer theme. I'm going to the second round, going Ryan Conwell. Because I am fascinated by Miami's guard room just in general. How that rotation is going to shake out. Eric Spoelstra has not been shy finding second round picks, undrafted guys. If you can knock down threes, if you can defend well enough, if you can just slot into whatever the system is going to be defensively, if we're going to be an aggressive group, a switching group, multiple zone looks, et cetera, if you can do that, there's going to be playing time for you. Ryan Conwell, if he can't do anything else, he will shoot the leather off the ball, do so with volume, and he's going to compete defensively at the very least. And so I cap out my draft with that because I think there's real opportunity for him to become an important backup guard for them because of the skill set that he possesses.
You just wanted to go there before Sam goes. You wanted to go there. You had people that you could have taken that I know you wanted to take. It's fine. Go ahead, Sam.
I see, like, I think there's a chance he carves out some time just because of what this backcourt situation looks like, but I think we're looking at a deal where it's like Davion Mitchell's pretty firmly ahead of him. Tim Hardaway Jr. pretty firmly ahead of him. Look, if Drew Smith is healthy, I think Drew Smith is going to play ahead of Ryan Conwell, because I think Drew Smith is a really good basketball player who makes good decisions and can really guard on that end. And then obviously Pelly Larson, I think, would be ahead of him as well. So, like, I don't. Look, he might just be such a good shooter that he ends up earning the time. But I would guess he will play some amount of minutes this year.
Some amount of minutes. I respect a letdown of a disagreement. That is fine with me, because this could have went the other way. So I appreciate the softness in which both of you handled me with my Ryan Conwell pick, but I'm sticking with it. That's how it goes. Steve, your selection.
Yeah, I've lived through the KZ Akpala era. I understand what you're doing here. It's fine. I get it. I understand. My final pick, give me Kingston Flemings. I don't know how many minutes he ends up getting, but I like his mindset. Lightning quick, but I just liked watching him in summer league and him deciding I would like to just do point guard things. If I drive and I see help, I'll finish, but I'll also make the right play. I'll get it out of there. I'll get off the ball. Defensively, I am willing to switch on anyone. So whoever is here, on ball, off ball, so many possessions of him just switching onto everyone. And then it's like, okay, that's transferable. Now, obviously teams might decide to attack him a little bit more. And he'll have to kind of be more consistent as far as like finishing and deciding when to shoot. It felt like this summer league, he had a mindset to, I need to make the right reads, make the right plays, play defense, play hard. I like that mentality in Atlanta. And so I kind of want to see what he looks like if he gets the minutes he could and how that transfers. What does he do every single night? Does the defense ramp up? Does the speed of his drives ramp up? Does he understand when to finish? But I like what he put together. The activity, the ball pressure felt consistent. I think if you are able to just do your job offensively, a lot of young players don't necessarily do that all the time. So I'm intrigued to see, okay, how do you build on that and add confidence with what we've seen scoring-wise or what we've seen playmaking-wise? And just, do you get it? If you get it already and you're saying, hey, I like Chris Paul, but I'm a lot faster, what's that look like? I'm intrigued.
Think fast, play fast. Like, that's the two things that Kingston Flemings brings to the table. Like, if you have the ability to play at hyperspeed and you have the ability to think at hyperspeed, I think that tends to be a pretty successful NBA basketball player at the end of the day. And Kingston can do those two things. Now, the shooting from beyond the three-point line and the finishing at the rim, those are the two, like, just skill set questions. Like, you look at his gathers going to the rim because he has kind of a slighter frame, he has shorter arms. Is he going to be able to maximize that ability to gather to the rim in order to be able to get there and be able to beat contests before they actually arrive to the rim, right? And then as a shooter, like, we'll see where the three-point shot falls, but he's comfortable from the mid-range at least. I assume he's going to be like a 15 to 20 minute per game backup point guard this year. So I think that he'll probably end up having a pretty important part of what Atlanta does.
I don't know. I love that. No notes on the Kingston Flemings pick. That's a good stuff.
All right. So I'll close this thing out. I went like so chalk, guys. Like I feel egregiously bad about doing this. I feel terrible about this, but I think that, like, when we had the conversation earlier about Braden Burry's, like, not being sure where he's going to settle in, I think Braden Burry's is going to be their most important guard this year. I think Braden Burry's is really good at basketball. Now, like, is Tyler Hero on the roster the entire year? We'll find out. Is he long-term for Milwaukee? We'll find out. But, man, I think Braden Burry's is a terrific defender. I think he's a very confident, aggressive scorer who has a real three-level scoring game. He can get all the way to the rim and score. He has a well-developed floater game. He can certainly shoot from three. He can play both on and off of the ball consistently. He's kind of a coach's dream as a rookie, at least, in terms of he can just kind of do a little bit of everything and makes the right decisions. He's aggressive without overstaying his welcome on the ball. Is the big thing for me.
I like that.
He's never gonna over dribble and try to overdo anything, but he's going to be aggressive. And if a lane presents itself, he's going to score at the end of the day. So, you know, look, I love Ryan Rollins too. I have questions as to whether or not Ryan Rollins is going to be on this team the whole way, because they can't extend him and he's an unrestricted free agent at the end of the year, right? So just contractually, it might make sense if he's not a guy that they're going to keep long term, or if they feel like they have to overpay to keep him long term, it might make sense to explore that, in my opinion. So, you know, we could be looking at a circumstance come January, February, where Braden Burries is kind of pushed Tyler Hero and Ryan Rollins a little bit, to where the Bucks have to make a decision on one of those two guys and end up moving one of them. I think Burries is that good. I'm a big, big fan of what he can bring to the table.
10 out of 10, no notes for me.
Yeah, like I enjoyed, first time I watched him, we got to one of those step backs. I was like, oh, he created like 6 feet of space. I'm in. That's all I needed to see. That's where you got into the drives and some of the playmaking flashes in the defense, as you mentioned. That's very well done. Very well done. So before we get out of here, I guess I'll start with you, Steve. Any honorable mentions? Anybody you want to shout out that you thought about picking very heavily, but you decided to get someone else, or just anyone we haven't said on the podcast yet that you want to give a quick nod to that you're interested to see?
I was so locked into the draft, I thought Sam had another pick.
I don't.
I was sitting here right in the fight.
Six man, go! No.
LeBaron Filon? Look, I know the context is going to be a lot different because, you know, LeBron James exists, but like, he's just had a presence offensively that jumps off to me every time I watch him. And like, can you do some of that with this team? And if you do some of that with this team, what's that look like? And that's probably the number one for me. And then I think I had the same vibes about Abuka Okoro in Detroit. Can you tween Tezzy your way into a vibe there?
I was so surprised you just didn't flat out pick him.
I was shocked you didn't take Braden Burries, Nikias. He's definitely going to try. It's going to happen.
Burries is on my board. It was just like, I just don't know how the early rotation is going to play out for Milwaukee. That was the only thing. Like, I'm in on the experience overall. That was kind of the only thing holding me back on him.
I think he's too good not to play at the end of the day. Like, I just really do. I mean, like, what are you really? I know they just gave Gary Trent $64 million, but you really
going to play did they.
Gary Trent over Braden Burries? Like, not a good sign necessarily. You just gave your guys $64 million, and I'm like, well, you can't play him over Braden Burries, right? But regardless, two other guys that, or maybe a few other guys I'll bring up. So the Malik Thomas Summer League experience, certainly, I don't know that it took me by surprise. It took me by surprise how successful he was. But the thing with Malik is he's a real ball watcher on defense, and he is a interesting decision maker on offense, let's go with. And Summer League is the kind of situation that really accentuates guys like Malik Thomas sometimes. But is he just so good that they have to play him? Like, is that the reality, that he just ends up being such a good scorer and such a dynamic playmaker that he ends up earning a spot on a real, you know, an Eastern Conference team that deigns itself as a contender? Maybe. Emmanuel Sharpe, like, I just love Emmanuel Sharpe. I think he's going to play in Sacramento. He guards. He is physical. He shoots. Sergio De La Rea, I thought, was really interesting at Summer League with the passing and playmaking. I think he's probably the backup, like, pseudo point guard in Dallas right now. Can he consistently make decisions with higher level athletes coming at him all of the time is a real question. And then the last one for me would be Hans Steinbach. I think Steinbach is just really good. Now, that's one where I don't know if he's going to get a whole lot of playing time, because he has both Musa Diabate and Ryan Kalkbrenner ahead of him. But I think Steinbach has unbelievable hands. I think he's the best offensive big of that trio right now, without any further development, because of his ability to play in short roles, his finishing ability. He can shoot a little bit from three. Like, he is just a real sharp decision maker and offensive player who just understands space at a high level and has touch. Are there moments where they're just like, all right, we're going to just kind of let him loose on offense and kind of see what it looks like?
Well, there we go. Well, you pretty much cleaned up my list. The only person that you didn't mention was Adai Mata from OKC. Just that is a lot of size, and that is a tall man that could pass the basketball as well. Just how much playing time does he get behind Isaiah Hartenstein? Yeah. Just what kind of trust do they give him? But everyone else, you pretty much cleaned up. So last question before we get out of here, Sam, what do you have coming up? What are you working on? Where can the people find you?
Good question. Sturts was the other guy that I had too, so I'm glad you brought up the OKC guys, because I assume Sturts just brings what they missed in the playoffs, right? Now they're going to get back Jalen Williams and AJ Mitchell and everything like that, but Sturts' ability to handle ball and shoot I think will be really important for them if they suffer more injuries, especially without Aaron Wiggins, Lou Dort, and Isaiah Joe around now too. Yeah, what do I have coming up? I don't know. Good question. Just go follow the Game Theory podcast. That's the easiest way to explain it. Like, go follow the Game Theory podcast. We will have some stuff coming here. I will probably have some stuff coming at The Athletic. Don't have anything planned right now. It's the off season, guys, but I'll have something coming at some point. Game Theory will be going strong, and that's what's going on. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you for rocking with us, Sam. We appreciate you. Hopefully more Sporacle. That's what we need from you during the offseason.
Hey.
But
I'm having fun.
There we go. Rock. I might.
Out. So like I've done two of those. There's a third one coming. I've gotten really close to drilling an entire draft. Like I've gotten really close. I missed today on the one. I missed Kalatzakis at 60. From what was that, 2021? I was so mad.
Thanks, Elliot.
I couldn't believe that I missed the Greek legend that was repped by the same agent as Giannis.
See, that's the kind of thing that I just cannot do because I'd be mad at myself and I just wouldn't be able to get over it. So I just got to stay away.
Oh,
for some of those
exercises. It's so much fun. No, first thing I do in the morning, find a new Sporacle quiz, test the brain out, keep it warm.
There you go.
Mine is always just a random, like, okay, Nikai, you're going to name 12 players on every team in the league to keep the brain sharp and keep up with transactions and stuff like that. Outside of that, like, I get mad at myself. But thank you, Sam, again, for rocking with us. We're going to take a break from here. And when we return, we shift to the W section. We're going to have a lot of fun bouncing around the league. Please stay tuned. I still don't quite know what to do with my hands based on the awesome basketball game that we got last night between the Las Vegas Aces and the Indiana Fever. It was going to be a bellwether matchup, as it always is. The Fever had won the first two matchups of the regular season. Again, we're coming off of the playoff series between those two that went to five games, despite Caitlin Clark being out. I was excited for this one. It's like, okay, this is the Aces on a road trip. This is the Fever finding some flow. These are, entering the game, the two best offenses in terms of offensive rating in WNBA history with a little bit of a gap. It's like, all right, this is going to be firepower. Let's see what defense steps up. And in the first quarter, nobody could make threes. It's like, okay. And then the second quarter happened, and the Fever looked like the Fever. And I tweeted out, this might be the most predictable game of the season because it looked like the same concepts that had bothered the Aces in this matchup. Or the healthy version of the Fever, where it's just, well, we can't really switch against them because they can bully us. We put two on the ball, we're in rotation. If we miss a shot, they push. If we make a shot, they still push, and they catch us on our back foot. And that was a lot of the second quarter. And then Jackie Young happened, well, and then the rest of the game happened. But that,
yeah, let's hang right there. Because, by the way, the tweet you put up saying this might be the most predictable game of the season, I immediately put Obafemi on that because what do you mean? This is insane. It was not predictable what happened. What I would say is the intrigue for me in this one was what lessons would the Fever learn coming off the Lynx game to apply to the Aces? But there it is. Aces Fever had a different tone as far as what they do. The Aces, neither team necessarily has the half-court defense to necessarily kind of glue things together. But they both can accomplish what they want to. The Aces came out the gates playing a little bit slower in the half-court, a little bit more methodical. Unfortunate part is that leaves the door open for the Aces. The Aces are going to make the Fever work in the half-court. But if the Aces transition defense gets hit, it's a different game. I think you saw that start to play out between the first and the second quarter where the Aces stopped scoring.
Like, they went to their bench unit and then they were not scoring. And the Fever were like, this is fantastic. We will absolutely push the ball. The problem is neither team is going to move from their identity. So if you get to a point where the Aces can find buckets, the Fever have to hit the ball in net. They now have to lock in the half court. The Aces half court defense may not be top tier, but we can lock in our enough stuff to get enough stops. And the shifting point was Jackie Young saying, absolutely not. And literally it felt like Jackie Young by herself erased that entire deficit. Yeah. In a quick fashion, where it's just like, you know what? I would like to tween Hezzy. Because that first quarter was a little off, where it was like, okay, this Asia's not really having an Asia game. Jackie's also a little quiet. It's back and forth, but the Aces aren't really hitting the pressure points. And then they subbed, and it was like, oof, they're really not scoring. Fever were like, we'll take that. And then Jackie M was like, I would like to take over the game for 7 consecutive minutes. And it's like, well, that makes things interesting. And then we get into a deeper back and forth. You know what I mean? So I didn't want to cut you off. But I feel like you have to the dynamic of this matchup is so important. Because if the Aces take too quick of shots, now the Fever can really get out and run in transition. So now we got wiggle room. We can get to our flow. We are out of here. We're running. We're gunning. We're getting shots up. If the Aces go too slow, well, that lets the Fever defense off the hook. And Caitlin Clark's like, I'll guard Kirsten Bell for the next 20 seconds. That's no problem. We're good. I found that so fascinating to watch these two teams trying to work through that, and then the game kept being the game.
That's probably the best way to put what the game turned into. Because I mentioned, I tweeted out, like, this is the most predictable thing because the Fever looked more like themselves in the second quarter. It got to 42-22, and I'm just like, ooh. It's like, well, not only were the Fever 2-0 against the Aces this regular season, and Asia missed one of those games, both of those wins were by double digits. Like, this had been, hey, we win, we you know, we set our tone, and this is just kind of what it is. And so when it got to 20, I was like, ah, okay. Neither team could really make shots in the first quarter. The Fever are making their shots in the second. As you mentioned, the sub thing, which is something that I've been monitoring when they go to, now since Dana Evans is back and healthy, it's been Chelsea, Dana, Jewel Lloyd, and Alyssa Smith, and then Bree Turner, kind of rounding out that bench unit to open the second quarter. I'm just like, in theory, that should be at least a quartet outside of Bree Turner. That should be a quartet that should score enough because Becky has wanted to keep Jackie and Asia kind of paired together and rest together because they have been insane together. But they worked so hard for their looks. And you saw in the second half when they went back to that lineup, and it was Jewel Lloyd kind of saving them towards the end of the third quarter with a couple of movement mid-range shots. It was like, they needed those baskets, but boy, did they have to work hard for those to be the shots that they got. So, like, that is something broader sense for the Aces to continue to monitor. I kind of wanted to hang on the defense portion because I'm glad that you hit on that. Because I think with the Fever, as they've been trying to find what their base is and just what level they can hit consistently all year long, against the Aces, they do look more comfortable than they do against other really good teams. And I think a lot of that starts with Aaliyah Boston is the rare big that has the strength to deal with the Asia drives, has the length to bother the Asia jumpers. And while she did end up with 5 fouls, it wasn't like an early foul trouble type beat where Asia get comfortable. And so I was tracking this early on. I think the first 7 shot attempts, at least for Asia Wilson, were all jumpers. I'm just like, you can make these shots because you are Asia Wilson. If you are the Indiana Fever, from your broader point, Steve, we're probably okay if you're not putting pressure on the rim because we're being physical with all of your off-ball stuff. And the Aces are going to stagger you to death with that particular action. We're going to face guard you, front you, be physical there. You're not going to get that advantage. You go pick and roll. We're going to try to keep it down the sideline. If you get the ball to Asia in the middle of the floor, we're okay with Aaliyah Boston defending her one-on-one. And we'll shrink the floor if we need to, but we're fine with that. And so as the Aces play slower, like you mentioned, it's like, okay, where exactly are you finding your advantages? And so for the Fever to look like that, it was intriguing to me. Go ahead. I have Aces thoughts.
Well, too, no, it's a weird matchup where I think the Fever find comfort defending the Aces, where they shouldn't necessarily on paper, but they don't necessarily feel the same pressure points that we've seen other teams. My mind went to like how the Aces try and attack the Liberty versus how the Aces try and attack the Fever. It's like, you're not automatically putting XYZ in action. So you're kind of just running what you want to run. And the Fever are saying, okay, we have a comfort with Aaliyah Boston guarding Asia. We could stay at home. If it takes you 10, 12 seconds to get to what you want to, we're fine with that. We'll live with it. the Aces didn't necessarily move them off that until they kind of just kept making shots. And that's the interesting part. Like, the Jackie Young portion was so important because when Jackie was able to just kind of make them pay, it got interesting. But it was a lot of, hey, Stephanie Talbert, do you want to drive? Like, you want to go off ball? We'll be physical. And I think that's, like, the beauty of watching these two teams kind of grow, because we saw last year in the playoffs, the Fever found a comfort with, we'll switch, we'll attack, we'll keep it in front, whatever, we'll fight you. Mm-hmm. Well, we also have all of our offensive players on the other end as well. So you have to deal with us being able to find a comfort defensively, but also score on the other end. So it was just kind of an odd, not odd, but, like, just a dynamic that, a comfort the Fever had defensively that I don't think they have against everyone else. And a pressure the Aces always present that the Fever didn't necessarily feel until it mattered.
No, I think that is more than fair. And I just wonder, like, broader strokes, like, who, which team can really shift the other one if this ends up being a series again, if it's a second round thing or a finals thing, depending on how the standings play out and things like that. But it is interesting watching the comfort, because on the other end, kind of wanted what to get to with the Aces defense. One, if I accelerate to the postgame presser, Becky Hammon started with praise for the defense, and she noted, this is not something that I've got to do super often, but I was very proud of our defense. And, like, one of the early possessions in that game was the Fever going double drag. You get a show from Alyssa Smith against Caitlin Clark. Asia rotates on time. Steph Talbert rotates on time. They go back to Caitlin Aaliyah. Two on the ball, Chelsea Green flies in and gets a steal. And it was one of those things where, like, it reminded me of what Becky said after the Liberty game, where she said, you know, they put two on the ball against Sabrina a lot. And I think she ended up taking, like, seven shots in that game overall. And she said towards the end of her comments, when I asked about the pick and roll aggression, that, yeah, we're going to do this a little bit more often moving forward. And I'm just like, okay, this is fascinating. And so I saw that early rep, and I'm just like, okay, cool. The first quarter kept going. I'm just like, ooh, I don't really love what some of these two on the ball reps are looking like. We get to the second quarter where, again, you mentioned the offense just was not found for the Aces, particularly when they went to some of their second unit. Fever get to play in transition. It's like, okay, well, what exactly are you establishing? For them to then turn it back around from the 4 minute mark onward in the second quarter into the second half and overtime, for them to be able to switch the way that they did, ramp up their aggression the way they did, and hold serve, it was if it wasn't literally their best defensive performance of the season, it was certainly their most impressive one, especially once you factor in, again, the Fever entered this game with easily the highest offensive rating of all time, or being on pace to do that. And it was wild to watch the Aces fly around and be that connected. Becky Hammon talked about the defense postgame. Chelsea Gray talked about the defense postgame. She complimented how connected they were defensively. And so I was just impressed by that. But at the back of my head, I'm also like, how do you balance that level of aggression with what this schedule is and with them being down a post? I think this is something else that Becky Hammon mentioned postgame. It's like, we don't have Cheyenne, so this is even more responsibility on Asia and Alyssa Bree Turner to work really hard on both ends of the floor. And so, like, I'm curious to see how the stamina portion of this is going to play out as we get to this August piece and then the World Cup break and everything like that. But very intriguing defensive performance from the Aces, to say the least.
Well, this is what the regular season is for. And so I won't go into the lore of me and you going back and forth on the Aces defense. I'll put that to the side. But I would say is, you have to have building blocks. You have to have reps. You have to have an ability to pivot. You have to have versatility. I think what the Aces showcased in that game against the Fever is an ability to try different things, to mix different things up, to be connected. And so I think there's a force that they play with. There are bones in that Aces defense that exist that will carry them in the playoffs. Are they going to get dinged in the regular season? Absolutely. They absolutely will. But the fact that they're making multiple efforts, the fact that they are connected, the fact that they are having games where our game plan is we're doing X, Y, Z, and they are knocking those things down, I think that's important. So I think you have to kind of watch the Aces roll out their defense to a degree in the regular season. Find out what they can do, what they can't do, how they pivot, how they adjust, how they work together to fly around. And you start to pick up the pieces of what they can put together in a playoff series. I think that's it. In the pure Aces viewpoint, this is a great team who wins championships. In a playoff context, we can now laser in on XYZ. And if we laser in on XYZ, having had the repetitions that we've had in the regular season, we can now build on that. So I think that's where I'm like, when we say, hey, the Aces defense isn't that great, I understand. But is it good enough to elevate what they do offensively? And I think that's a question for both of these teams. Can you get your defense to good enough to accentuate what you do offensively? And I think that's another lesson for the Fever, right? Like the Fever got put into a box to a degree because now you're playing a different type of game. You have to execute in the half court. It's not that you can't. You had Caitlin Clark playing well. You had Kelsey Mitchell, who, by the way,
buckets
will not stop scoring. You had Aaliyah Boston going, so you had your offensive threats, but are they being impactful in the same way that is forcing the Aces to rotate or react in a certain way? Are you putting that pressure? Are you able to get to those buckets every single time? Are you getting to the same kind of flow in the half court? The Aces have a comfort, even if it looks slow at times, playing that style of basketball, because we know what Jackie can do. We know what Asia can do. We know what Chelsea can do. So we will be able to navigate what you feel like is mud. This is our home. So that's where it's like, what's this look like in a playoff matchup?
No, I think that part is fair. And I think if that reminded me of, I think opening the fourth quarter, they had the graphic up from the Amazon broadcast of the players that were kind of outperforming their expected efficiency. And on the graphic is four Aces players, four of their five starters in the top 14. And I'm just like, you know, it's a testament to their shot making. It's also like, hey, can you get easier looks? But it also circles back to something that you said. There's like, okay, if this does become more of a muddy game, we don't want to be here, but we can be. And at the end of the day, we can get a random Nelissa Smith turnaround, who also just had a quality game, at least offensively, in this one. Chelsea Gray, who just could not get mid-ranges to go in this game, knocks down the two biggest threes of the game to close out regulation and then to also end the game in overtime. Asia Wilson just could not get shots to go and then scores 18 of her 26 in the fourth quarter in overtime. Jackie Young, we get to the 236 mark of the second quarter before she really got going, but to the four-minute mark of the second quarter, had 2 points before she said, I am not going to stop scoring. And it's just like, the Aces are infuriating in that way, especially for me as like a process person. Because for me, it's like, what are you generating? What is the ease in which you're generating good looks, et cetera? And sometimes it's just like, we're just better than you. Sometimes we can just go on heaters and there isn't anything you can do about it.
I don't mean to make you upset here, but the process sometimes is a talent. In what felt like 7 or 8 bad possessions, feel a lot better when Jackie Young says, absolutely not. I don't care. I'm going to score the basketball. What do you do with that? And to the Asia Wilson part, I know you didn't enjoy much of that Asia performance to a degree. And watching it, I felt like, ooh, this is not an Asia game. Here's the problem. It's not an Asia Wilson game until it's an Asia Wilson game.
Yeah.
And once it became an Asia Wilson game, what do you do with that? It's just a reminder. Like, yeah, we've done a great job making Asia Wilson not have a great game. And then Asia says, actually, I'll score.
Midi time.
You didn't change the mindset. You didn't change the talent. And now you have to deal with this. Like, what is this? What is this? This is a surcharge. Like, what have I paid my bill. This is, why am I being taxed? So, do you know what I mean? Like, you enjoy the effort. You enjoy the effort you made until you realize Asia Wilson is now scoring. And now we have to deal with this Asia Wilson, this Jackie Young, and the potential that if we defend those two, Chelsea Gray could get the basketball and do things. That's the problem the Aces always present. And that's why they're always in the mix. And like, I understand the roller coaster that the Aces can take people on sometimes, but you got to understand, they know who they are. They know what they can do, and they know what they can get to. And in moments like these, you see it. That end of game set, I thought they were done. I thought they were done. Free throws missed. Timeout. Let's drop a set. Shout out to Stephanie Talbot, but Stephanie Talbot said eject immediately on an inbound pass. I know who's supposed to get the ball. I'm throwing it there immediately. Tip ball, 3-point. Oh my. You got a chance to win. Like you have to beat the Las Vegas Aces. If you're going to win, you have to beat them. They're not going to give it to you. And so they get that stop. They push. Chelsea Gray in transition. Bucket. Yeah. You see Nola's face when Chelsea Gray made that shot? Did you see the reaction from the Aces bench when Chelsea Gray made that shot?
Can't believe this is my life.
But I mean, that's where it's like, okay, you got to develop that. I think for Caitlin Clark is a learning moment. That's where you got to go. You got to go. Mm-hmm. It's not about anyone else on the court. You got to go. You can't look for anyone else. You got to go on that moment. Didn't get it. They made a move. Chelsea Gray entered you. Now, how do you handle it?
I actually wanted to ask you about the final play because watching it live, I was just like, holy crap, this is awesome. What a game, et cetera. I literally tweet out the clip and it's like, oh my God, with a bunch of random letters. After I calm down, I watch it back. And I'm just like, okay, there are some interesting things happening here. So as you referenced, I think, getting to this final possession, the Aces pretty much like draw a floppy and Jackie misses a wing three. It's like, okay, well, that's unfortunate. Let's see what's going to happen here. Mikayla Timpson, as the fever has sprinkled in throughout this game, sets a screen behind half court for Caitlin. And the Aces switch that one. And I'm just like, surely the Fever are just going to be like burning clock. I don't know if you had to switch that when you're half court. I don't think this is a situation where they want to push and go. But they switch. And I think the switch threw Caitlin off. Because I think if Jewel Lloyd just continued to navigate that, I think that's just going to be an immediate, we are going to Aaliyah Boston in a pick and roll. Because then it's Jewel and Alyssa Smith navigating that. And we feel like we can get something good. You get the switch. It is now Asia here. And it's like, well, do I want to go pick and roll? Because this may just be like you could still get Alyssa on a switch. And maybe that's an easier matchup for her to attack in space. But then it's just Asia on Aaliyah Boston. So we don't get the same juice out of that because the Aces were mixing in switches with the blitzes that we saw throughout that game. And Asia Caitlin tries to go one-on-one. Asia deflects the pass. And Chelsea Gray once again caps it. And it was just like, huh. This is a more fascinating possession than I felt like it was live when I actually removed the emotion from it. I'm just like, beyond half-court screen is interesting. The decision to switch that one was interesting. Caitlin trying to figure out in real time, do I want a screen or am I just going to go? Because she is motioning to her left early on and then just decides to attack. And so she's trying to sort through and process all that in real time. And then we get the possession that we get, the battle of the 22s, and then Chelsea Gray seals it in. It was just a really interesting close to the game.
I think those reps are important for the Fever to understand those moments. Like the high pick and roll was a response to what the Aces did activity wise. Like, cool, if you want to trap, well, guess what? We'll set the screen behind half court. You got to deal with it. Problem is, Asia Wilson switch. And now it's like, well, all right, go time. And now, is that a moment where they'll reflect on that and we get into another screen, as you mentioned? Do we get the ball to Kelsey Mitchell? Do we play out of it? They went one-on-one because Caitlin Clark is very talented at basketball. So, okay, let's see what's cooking here. Didn't necessarily get what they wanted. Asia gets the steal, and now it's off to the races. So I think the lesson for the Fever is trying to figure out how they can elevate to beat those top two teams. You know what I mean? Like, to you test your talent, you test your strength against the Lynx, against the Aces. What can we learn from these two matchups to where we can prepare ourselves in the playoffs? If you're the Aces, this is business as usual. We're on a long road trip. We're trying to get whatever we can on this. We're taking everyone's best shot. And if we are able to win these on the road, boy, you got to deal with us in a different way. Talk to us nicely.
Talk to us nicely indeed. Couple of things I'll note as we shift away from this game. You mentioned the bucket getting of Kelsey Mitchell in this one. 28 points in this game. This is now 15 straight games with 20 or more points, which ties Asia Wilson in 2024 for the most consecutive 20-point games in WNBA history during their 15-game stretches of 20-plus. Kelsey Mitchell averaging 27.7 points and shooting over 50% from three on 7.5 attempts, which is absurd. Asia during hers, it was the first 15 games of the 2024 season in which she set the scoring record, won MVP, et cetera. Averaged 28 points per game during her stretch, I think 52 from the field, over 40 from three. So it's just fascinating that Kelsey Mitchell is doing this for this team. That part is fun for me. And then the last thing I'll add just on the Aces defense, again, continuing to track just how often they are putting two on the ball, watching the blitz rate continue to creep up and up and up as the months go by. The fact that the Aces can hit certain levels defensively in the playoffs is when you need to, you have to do it consistently or you just go home. But if we're planting seeds and now you have a fever matchup to where we have our highest blitz rate of the season against the best offense of all time in terms of offensive rating, and we hold them to 84 with extra time, I think that's a matchup you can always go back to. Like, no, this first quarter is bad. Y'all just did this against the fever. I know you got it in you. Easy thing to point back to for some motivation there. So just wanted to highlight that portion as we
Sorry, before we pivot, you're saying the Indiana Fever have the best offense of all time.
I am so mad that you did that. I cannot believe that you just did that. I do think they still have the highest offensive rating of all time, but
all time.
You know what? Just to quickly pivot, Steve, I'm sure you have, but have you seen the standings heading into this weekend?
Yeah,
because the potential matchups that we have right now are kind of absurd. Just to quickly run through, as of today, before the Friday slate, your 1-8 would be Lynx Mystics. Mm. If you're watching this podcast, Cheryl Reeve is probably still mad about her defense that the Lynx displayed against the Sparks on Thursday night. So that would be your 1-8. That is insane. Your 2-7 would be Aces Liberty. And I think both teams are, they respect each other, but I'm sure both teams are just tired of each other at this point with all the matchups that they've had since 2023. That'd be your 2-7. Your 3-6 would be Valkyrie's Fever. Which, hey, if we're talking about fever lessons and things, what can we establish defensively? What can we get to consistently offensively? The Golden State Valkyries and their defense seems like quite the test if that's your first round matchup. And then your 4-5 is Dream Wings, which would be an interesting styles clash. Also an interesting clash of just fan bases who have both been super high and fed up with their own basketball teams at various stages of this season. That'd be fun, Steve. Look, that'd be a lot of fun.
Look, my people, mi gente, look at me. Look me directly in my eyes. Hear my voice. The first round is going to be cinema. No one's going to have a fun time. Whatever you feel about your team, it's not going to feel any better than right now. Because you get to that first round, there is no easy matchup. There is no team that you can easily beat. You have to find a way to win. So buckle up and enjoy the ride now, because it's only, and I mean only, going to get more verse.
That it is. That it is. We got some fun ones. You already alluded to the Aces. They have the weekend back-to-back. They have the early game against the Lynx on Saturday.
What's the back-to-back? Say it again.
Lynx at 1 Eastern on Saturday. Liberty at 12:30 Eastern on Sunday. Both road games for the Aces. And then it's like, cool, they go back at home on Tuesday. Guess who they play? The team that handed them a loss heading into the All-Star break and currently on the win streak right now, the Washington Mystics. Welcome home. Here are the Mystics ready to beat you up. It's a fascinating stretch of games for the Las Vegas Aces, which actually I'll quickly ask you, Steve, since I've alluded to them already. This Mystics group, we keep sprinkling in the praise because they keep winning. They're on a 5-game win streak right now. Are they just going to like move? Are we going to blink and in a week and a half just going to be like the 5 seed? Like, should we just start preparing ourselves for them not just being in the playoffs because they are firmly in the top 8 right now, but they could just fight for a home court seed? Like, I think they're what, a game and a half, 2 games out of 4?
They are putting themselves in a spot. Now, I will say this has been a massive homestand for the Mystics. The Young and the Restless have won a lot of games in Washington. So eventually they will have to leave and we'll see what happens. But again,
I will praise it. I will preach it. I will say it again. This team knows who they are. This team is winning, so there's more buy-in. This team is going to defend. They're going to drive the basketball, and you're going to get 40 minutes of four bigs determined to make your life absolutely horrible. And on top of that, not like Sonya Citron's going to stop. Not like we won't get Cody McMahon trying to drive. Not like Georgia Amor won't take a shot. They know what they do. And because they have found success with it, as far as victories go, there's more belief as the season goes on. There's not a fear. You can't shift them from what they are. Like, I think that's the biggest thing I want people to know about the Mystics. Maybe some nights they don't have enough. It's rarely because the team has shaken them into, we can't play. No. Our style of play just didn't work. But when it works, we do it. We saw it in the Dallas game. Dallas was getting after the Mystics. It never stopped the Mystics from being the Mystics. That's an important piece. So I don't know where it takes them. I don't know how far it takes them. But the Mystics are the Mystics, and they are here. The pump fake has finally paid off.
This is long-term storytelling. If you've been a subscriber to Dunker Spot Podcast for more than a few years, I would just say 5-game win streak for the Washington Mystics right now. 4-0 in clutch games. They are 13-6 in clutch games overall this season. For a team that young, that is absurd. They're tied with the Lynx for the most clutch wins in the league this year. Quick trivia, Steve. Do you know who has the best win percentage in clutch games so far this year?
The Portland Fire.
Absolutely not. It is the Atlanta Dream. 9-4, over 65% of their game, 65% win rate for the Atlanta Dream, which is fascinating as they continue to be in this cluster. Last free throw, I'll toss you away. Are you concerned about the Dallas Wings?
Hey, remember that time we did a podcast and I asked a lot of questions about the Dallas Wings? And you could probably play that right now and it would be relevant. You could do that. Mm-hmm. I asked questions. Who in their big room feels good about coming to work right now? It still applies. It's not different. We're in the same boat. Alana Smith got taken out of the starting lineup and just got back into the starting lineup. And I don't know. At some point, this team has to trust their bench to play well. They've done a lot of good things this season. You have to trust your team above your system, in my opinion. You've got to put your players in a position to where they play with a level of belief. That whole thing, when I watched it back and the starters started the fourth quarter, you put yourself in a box. So, yes, you've had great performance from Paige. Yes, AZ Fudd's been fantastic. Arike has adjusted. It's been good. Jessica Shepherd's been fantastic. What's around it? Have you built something for the other people around it? Or is it situational? And yeah, you're winning games, but do you trust what you get? Because if you go through the names of Alana Smith, Leah Rue, Maddie Segrist, Awat Kouye, it's been up and down. Go to the game log. It's been up and down.
Yep.
At some point, that's got to be a stronger base to accentuate the good things you've done. I think that's the bit. So I go back to the archives, see how I yelled early in the season, and just amplify it. That's all I'll say.
Copy and paste. Okay. That is fair. Yeah. The Awak versus Leah Rue thing has been interesting to me because I think Jose is getting a little spooked by some of the, I guess, physicality or lack thereof from Awak. Like, I go back to one of the earlier Mystics games where very early on, it is Kiki driving into her chest and moving her like 4 feet. And then it's a turnover on the other end from Awak short after. It's like, well, we're probably not going to see much of her after this. And sure enough, we did not. I would like to see the trust risen because of how important Awak has been to the defense overall. They're not going to hang there too long. We may get deeper into that on Tuesday, but just wanted to sprinkle in some thoughts. Okay. Couple of roster notes, Steve, to close things out. First, broader strokes. Team USA announced their roster. We have the 12, at least as of now. Because I do wonder if we're going to see any changes before the competition actually starts. But we'll get there a little bit later. But we do have the Team USA World Cup roster. Your guards, Caitlin Clark, Paige Beckers, Kelsey Plum, Chelsea Gray. Your wings, Jackie Young, Ryan Howard, Kalia Copper. Your forwards, Breanna Stewart, Nafisa Collier. Your bigs, Asia Wilson, Aaliyah Boston, Angel Reese. How do you feel about the roster, Steve? Any surprising names in? Any surprising names left out?
I mean, I can understand how some people may feel like there were snubs. Mm-hmm. It's weird to not see Sabrina on this roster, but I understand with the talent that we, like Team USA has, you get to this. And like, for people saying Ka shouldn't be on here, do you understand that when Ka puts a Team USA uniform on, she becomes a 97 overall? Not that she's not already great, but like, Ka Team USA is a 97 overall and becomes a completely different person. And I think the versatility of this roster is what stands out. We have a bunch of bigs. We have a lot of guards. We have wings. We can play different lineups. And like, there are waves that can kind of hit. So I think that's always been the consistent thing with Team USA is like, we're going to build a roster that can just really overpower you throughout a game. And so, I know Olivia Miles was mentioned, but like, hey, gotta come to camp. that's where my thing is. Like, I'm not necessarily shocked to a degree. Was there anything that spooked you or any thoughts you have with the roster? Because we saw this team play a few months ago, and it's like, yeah, okay, I see what we're building here. I see the vision.
Yeah, they went 5-0 during qualifying games. And this is with like obvious placeholders. Like, we didn't see Asia, we didn't see Stewie, we didn't have Fee and things like that. And they were still very good. And so it's interesting to see some of the younger slash newer names get some time in the system. And that is baked off of the players that attended the camps and things. And so just from a pure merit standpoint, like, yes, I would have loved to have seen Olivia Miles on this roster. But as you mentioned, I understand why she isn't when you consider how deep the guard pool is. The players that are very good and have previous Team USA experience, it's like, okay, I see how you landed here. And also, we are, what, 2 years removed from the Olympic conversations and how wild all of that got in regards to Caitlin Clark? And like, now she's here and like, we're not going to hear that? Are we just going to copy and paste that to Olivia Miles? I guess you can in the name of consistency, but like, this is just generally how they go about it. Sue Bird, Team USA, held a Zoom yesterday. And Sue noted, like, it's not like a firm, if you do not participate in camp, you are just automatically out. But it does help with the evaluation. And I think historically, you can just look. They want players that they've gotten to look at. You know what I mean? Or at the very least, they've been in the pipeline in other competitions with Team USA to kind of give them a little bit of a buffer. Olivia Miles was on the 2025 AmeriCup team, I want to say. Her and Michaela Blakes were on that team. Michaela Blakes was in one of the camps. Olivia Miles did not play in either one of the camps or didn't participate in either one of the camps. So it's just like, okay, we did have some college participation. I think Lauren Betts and Juju Watkins was there in December. Michaela Blakes was there in the April camp. That's where Olivia comes behind eight ball a little bit. But Sue noted, like, hey, she's absolutely going to be a part of this moving forward. Watch her play basketball. It's hard to argue against that. You know what I mean? And for me, broadly speaking, as for me, and you know, we've had these conversations across the NBA and the W, Steve, where if you do get to like the non-Olympic competitions, like I generally want those to trend younger anyway. And so that's another reason why, like, I would have been fine if, okay, Chelsea, you were preparing for a playoff push, plus I'm sure you are going to want the last hurrah with the 28 Olympics. Let's get Olivia Miles in here, get her more experience, et cetera. And then maybe both of y'all are just on the Olympic team at 28, or we'll see what happens on that front. So for me, no real surprises. No heavy snubs like Kelsey Mitchell, the other one. I was looking at her Team USA page. The last time she participated in anything Team USA was in 2023, and that was 3-on-3. And so I can't say I am super surprised that she's not on the 505 group, though obviously she has played at an electric level, and I certainly wouldn't be upset if she made it. And then the last thing for me, Steve, I was trying to think of some names. If we did get any kind of like injury replacement or like I got to talk to Asia about a week and a half ago, asking her if she is locked in on World Cup play, considering the August schedule and things. If we get any kind of replacements, I did have a list of names for you, Steve, of some players that may be in consideration here for potential replacements. So in the guard group, mentioned Sabrina, who didn't make this team, but obviously has prior Team USA experience. Veronica Burton, who was a part of the training camps for Team USA. Sonya Citron and Ray Burrell in the wing group. Kiki Irifin, Kayla Thornton, who was also part of the April camp for Team USA, Monique Billings, who was on the qualifying roster, as was Ray Burrell. Shakira Austin, De'Erica Hamby, Cameron Brink all participated in the camps as well. And as noted on the screen, for the people that aren't watching on YouTube, Ray Burrell and Mo Billings were the only two players that participated in both of the World Cup training camps and also was on the World Cup qualifying roster earlier this year. So if we do get replacements, I would imagine it's probably Ray and Monique, probably towards the top of the list. So don't be surprised if those are your call-ups. That's not a source thing. That is just you were just participating in literally everything type beat. Are any of those names... any of those names speak to you in terms of like replacements, or am I off? Or am I missing anybody?
You're not off. I think that was a fantastic list. I think like if there are going to be replacements, hopefully everyone is healthy and able to go and play. But if there are replacements, you're going to want versatility. You're going to want size. You're going to want defense. You're going to want people who can do different things. So I think every name you listed was a positive to a high degree. So I love that list. It's fantastic.
All right, to close this one out, Steve, and we will spend more time on this on Tuesday because I'm sure we'll just have more information by Tuesday. The New York Liberty made some roster moves post-trade deadline, did not make a trade, but Wade's Benaja Laney-Hamilton. They're also going to sign Maureen Fatoux to a multi-year deal. She was on a development contract coming up against the game's limit there. Steve, I saw your tweet after the news was announced. And I think it was just unreal. And so I just kind of wanted to concede the floor to you to give your thoughts on how this Liberty Benaja situation has played out.
Hear me and hear me good. There's no Liberty championship without Benaja Laney-Hamilton. There is absolutely no Liberty championship run without Benaja Laney-Hamilton. There's no rebirth. There's no roster move that makes this make sense. This doesn't exist without what Benaja did. As far as choosing the Liberty, as far as being there for the Liberty, beyond before, like Stewie, Jonquel, fantastic. Benaja held it down for a very long time. And then Benaja elevated this team once they became what everyone called a super team. And Benaja was so good that, hey, we need someone else who also does what Benaja does. And that was the championship formula. That's what it was. But this was a player that defended everyone that was ever thrown at her, was able to score at any level needed. If you need me to run pick and roll, it's fantastic. You need me space, it's good. A post up against a mismatch, it's whatever. Benaja Laney-Hamilton was a Liberty through and through. And you don't get to this without what she did. And I feel like that should not be forgotten. That should not be mistaken. That should not be something that people don't understand. You are not talking about the Liberty in the same ways that you have been if Benaja does not do what she does. And so I personally salute her for her efforts to elevate this team and salute her for her efforts to bring this team a championship because they don't win a title without her. And so I want to make that clear. Now, secondarily, very quickly, I will say, since this happened, go to Washington.
Oh, okay.
Teach them how to cook all on right. low.
We will have more Benaja thoughts on Tuesday. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Oh, dear. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main channel. That's where our WNBA content will live. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports NBA YouTube channel. That's where our NBA content will go. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week. Oh, my goodness.